You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is Jason, and with me in conversation is Jamie. And this is episode 43. And today we want to be looking at the question, and we're beginning a series on the atonement of Jesus Christ, so looking at his death and what his death means for us, and what ultimately was accomplished objectively when Jesus died on the cross. What was the purpose behind it? What did God have intended for us in that death, and what did it accomplish? So before we get to all of the talk about what was his death about, we need to find out, what is it about us that requires an atonement in the first place? So today we want to be talking about the nature of our sin, our sinful condition. We're asking the question, what is wrong with us anyway? As a human race, I think very few people today would say that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the human race, that there's nothing wrong with our world, that if things are just as good as they could be, you know, we don't exactly live in a utopian society, even though if you live in the Western world, we have so many, so many benefits on the economic and commercial level. But at the same time, we all recognize there is something wrong with the human race. There's something inherently wrong. And yet how people have interpreted what's wrong with us has differed. It's different throughout history. People from the time of the ancient Greek philosophers, guys like Aristotle, took a very pessimistic outlook on humanity. He said basically it's better to not be born than to be born, because every human goes through suffering, and suffering ultimately is pointless. There's no meaning behind our suffering, so it's better to not even exist at all than to be born into this world. Other guys didn't take such a bleak outlook, but what they did is they looked at the human person and they saw, okay, there's this rational side to humanity, to the human person, this mind, or in some cases it was the soul that they were looking at, and that in the Greek is the nous, or the mind, and that's a good part of humanity, but our bodies, our flesh, our physical tangible existence is ultimately evil, or it's corrupt. And essentially they would look at the corruption in the human race and in human history, and they'd say that is the result of our bodies, our physical side, but our spiritual side, our minds are the pure principle. That's the good part of us. And of course there's been various views on humanity's origin from time of Epicurus and way before that, where essentially people viewed the world with a very mechanistic outlook. And this is seen even in the way naturalists today, and I'm talking about scientific, philosophical naturalists, when they look at the human being, they see, okay, we've got this tissue, these bones, these nerve cells and neurons firing, that physical makeup, that chemical makeup is what a human being is. We're mammals. We're mammals with hair. We're Homo sapiens. But ultimately we are nothing more than an organism, and at death, that's it. Lights out. There's nothing beyond death, because all we are is our physical makeup. And then there's the people who have a very positive, optimistic outlook. And I'm gonna want us to distinguish later, Jamie, between having a very hopeful outlook on the human race and having a very optimistic, in this sense anyway, and that is of humanism. Humanism is very optimistic when it comes to seeing the human race as progressing and on the uptrend. You know, things are only going to get better as we increase levels of education, healthcare, travel, communication, technology, all of that. we're only on the upswing. We're only going to get better. And really, in the humanist mind, what human beings need to be free of is religion and superstitious and most importantly, this institutionalized form of religion. And all of that is to say that there has been various interpretations of how to understand us and our situation and what's wrong with us. Because clearly, if you look at the world, nobody can deny that there's staggering levels of starvation among children all over the world. There's staggering levels of orphans, suffering, disease, cancer, murders, homicide, rapists. All of these actions and people that we see in the world today are indicators that something has gone tremendously wrong. And what we're going to argue is that we need, ultimately, if we're going to understand ourselves, you know, it's been said that man has always been his own most vexing problem. Reinhold Niebuhr said that. And in a sense, he was saying, if we are going to understand anything about the world and our existence, we've got to understand ourselves. What's going on inside of us? And until we get to the bottom of that, we're going to be a mystery to ourselves. We're not going to understand why we behave the way we do, why we like the things we like. And the biblical revelation we have, we believe, obviously, is divine revelation from God. It speaks a better word than all these human-centered perspectives, because it tells us that we have, as a human race, we have been created for a purpose, that that ultimately we are created, we're designed for a relationship with our Creator. And this points us back to humanity's origin. And according to Scripture, Jamie, feel free to jump in on this, but what we see in Scripture is that humanity was made in a perfect, pristine condition where there was no sin. And that can be hard right there. That can be something hard for people to swallow because of what they see going on in the world today. So, Jamie, why don't you maybe just take a stab at what are some important aspects of understanding that fact that we were designed with, for instance, perfect health, perfect, you know, disease-free environment. And why is that so different from what we see today?
Yeah, for sure. We would argue, first of all, that we only have one identity statement given to us by God in the Bible. And that comes from Genesis 1 and 2, where we see that we are made in the image of God, this imago Dei reality. You know, God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. And so we are created in the image of God. And we actually talked about this quite a bit back on the What is a Man episodes we did here a couple weeks ago, where, you know, we were really looking at the question, can being a man be defined separate from its function? And inherently the answer is really no, because our identity is so wrapped up in the nature and character of God. We are made in His image, and therefore we have characteristics and attributes which are God-like in a sense. Not that we are gods, but we express small versions of the nature and character of God. And so all the good that is in us, you know, stems directly from the nature and character of God, which is why for us in our perfect design, we are made for relationship with God, because only by getting closer to the source of our identity are we able to live and walk out that design that God has for us. And that's what you really see in Genesis. We were perfect as God created us, and in perfect relationship with God. In fact, Adam and Eve, the first man and woman in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, they are in relationship with God. Like, they're physically walking with God, they're physically talking with God. That relational unity is perfect. And as a result, then our design as humans is perfect. Now, granted, this is also before the tainting of sin, yet the orientation was good. It was centered in the nature and character of God, and as a result, it expressed itself in all of its perfect forms as God intended it to be. Now, you know, we live outside of that reality. We live post-Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve decide to sin. They decided being in perfect relationship with God as God intended was not good enough. We needed to become like God, knowing what God knows, of being able to determine good and evil. And so they decided to listen to a lie, and as a result, really began worshiping another god, in a sense, because they're looking for what can only be found in relationship with God in a proper sense in something else, really in themselves to a great degree, because they thought by disobeying God and eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they would become basically God. So and the result is then a series of rebellion and a heart orientation towards rebellion against God. In fact, what's really interesting is, you know, when you get to Genesis 6, you have the sons of God and, or the how does that go? The angels of God and the daughters of man, and they're coming together. And the result is this evil that God, you know, deals with really harshly. In fact, completely wipes out and, you know, starts over with humanity with Noah. And what is really fascinating is you notice whenever the two lines come together, the sons of God and the people of earth or men, the ones walking in accordance with their flesh, I guess you could say. Every time those two lines come together, it's great evil. And what's interesting is those lines always come together all throughout the Old Testament, where we see the people of God really moving towards idolatry, really moving towards sin and evil and corruption and perversion. And so no question, outside God's perfect design that's found in Genesis 1 and 2, we just see this constant pull of the human heart towards evil and rebellion. And this really isn't, I don't think it's too hard for us to understand, Jason. I mean, at least I can speak for myself in saying, like, I see that my innate orientation is towards myself, towards selfishness, towards me being my own God, in a sense, and really that rebelliousness of spirit that's like, I don't want to obey God, I don't want to do what he's called me to do or to walk in relationship to his design. So it's really not hard to see how that corruption has happened in us.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, one of the most common objections you will find if you talk to people who don't follow the Christian faith is they will say, well, how could there be a good God if you look at all the corruption, you look at all the disaster? I mean, this world is a mess, and you're saying a good God made all of this? Well, that is why what you've been talking about, Jamie, and really what we would want our listeners to understand is that God's design for the world originally is not what we see today. And there was this massive, literally world-shaking event in the fall of Adam and Eve. And really, it's interesting how the responsibility, the blame, if you will, is consistently placed squarely on Adam as the man in that relationship. But here's just one example. This is Romans 5:12, where it explains the consequences of our sin and what has been brought upon us. It says in Romans 5:12, therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. And so we see that there's this, just like a engine pulls the next train or car in the train, sin is what led the way to death and suffering. We only see this as a result of man's fall. We were originally designed for this beautiful, amazing relationship with God, and because we have, as a human race, turned away from Him, we see all these consequences today. And I don't know about you, Jamie, but I think a lot of people today, when they hear that word sin, I think they bristle, don't they? They sense that is a, I mean, it sounds like a very churchy word. It sounds old-fashioned, outmoded. A lot of people, I think, bristle when they hear the word sin, when they hear sin talk, because it goes against this human inclination to want to see ourselves in a better light. And even though, as you said, you just point out, you know, if we search our own hearts, we're gonna find selfishness happening in our hearts pretty quickly. But at the same time, people will want to say, "Yeah, but I'm mostly good, or I'm on the whole, I'm a good person. Sure, I do things here and there that I'm not proud of. You know, everybody has their flaws, so to speak. But I'm on the whole, I'm a good person. Think of all the good things I do." And so that's why I want us to look at this question of what is sin. When we say that we are a sinful human race, are we just being really negative here, Jamie? How does the Bible answer that question, most importantly? Because I think this is a question that our culture is looking at the church and thinking, why are you being so negative in your outlook on the human condition?
Yeah, so I think that question begins, at least in a biblical context, with you have to define the parameters, right? So something I've noticed that I think is inherent in all of our hearts is that we choose a standard that we can exceed, right? So if my particular issue is selfishness, well, then I look at the husband who's so selfish that he's not loving his wife, he's not caring for his kids, he's not, you know, engaging his community, he's not serving, he's not giving, he's not, and then I go, phew, by that standard, I mean, I'm a good dude, right? Or you could say the same thing. I think another good example would be like when it comes to like lust, for example. You're like, well, I mean, I only thought sexually about all these women, but I didn't, you know, look at pornography. I didn't engage with any women, or I didn't cheat on my wife, or I didn't, you know. Again, the point is we've made the standard one that we can bear up to, right? And by that standard, we then look pretty good. 'Cause when I choose somebody way worse than me, in that sense, I mean, this is all superficial and subjective in a sense, but by that standard, this is how I'm deciding that I'm a pretty good guy. The problem is that from a biblical perspective, God's standard is His own holiness, His own perfection. That's the standard of God. And by that standard, then we realize very quickly how not good we are. In fact, I know, Jason, we've talked about this before, where it seems like the closer we get to the holiness of God, the more we realize how sinful we are. It's like it feels like you're becoming more sinful. It's not that we're becoming more sinful. It's as we get closer to the perfect, how sinful we are becomes apparent. You know, the Bible says, like in Jeremiah 17:9, I think it is, it says the heart is desperately wicked above all else. Who can know it? Like it's so sinful that we don't even see the depths of how sinful it is. And so going back to we're created in the Imago Dei reality, we're made in the image of God. Therefore, our standard goes back to God. And if you want to argue out, okay, well, how do I know God has the authority to be the standard? Then you go back to, what is God? Well, first of all, God is the creator. God is the sustainer. I mean, we're told that in like Hebrews 1, Colossians 1, John 1. In each of these cases, you know, God is not just the creator. He is the one physically holding all things together. So he's the creator. He's the sustainer. He's the orderer. He's the one that put into design in the cosmos how everything works, including interaction between humans and humans and animals and humans and creation. And so, and then if you want more proof positive, then you ask the question, well, is God really the highest authority? And one of the cool things is this is a question that is explored by God himself. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 6, we see this, where God goes out looking for a higher authority than himself to swear by, because he's decided, I want to swear by the highest authority, and so he's going to go and look. Now, this is an exercise for us, right? Because God is not confused. He it's not like he doesn't know what or who is the highest authority. He's just sort of doing this for our benefit, and he ends up concluding there is no higher authority than him, and as a result, then he swears by himself, because there isn't a higher authority. So God is the creator, the sustainer, the orderer, and the highest authority, which means then that we then build out based on God's rules. Since he is the highest authority, then it's his standard that we get to go by.
Yeah, and you get the sense that, and really what we're talking about is sin as rebellion. It's rebellion against our Maker. And this is borne out in many ways because of how sin is described in the Bible. For example, we've got words like pesha. Pesha in Hebrew, transgression. It means going beyond set limits, going into areas we know we aren't supposed to go into. There's the word hata, which means to miss the mark. And it's not saying like, oh, you know, we try to hit the bullseye, but man, despite our best efforts, we just miss every time. No, it's that we are intentional. Well, intentionally, because we have this sin nature, we are going against the target God has designed for us, and we're shooting in the opposite direction. We're going away from God. And there's many other words that you know, it's sin is described as an offense, as going astray, as rebellion. And in all these ways, we're seeing that at the root of sin, and this is something C.S. Lewis talks about in Mere Christianity, but maybe at the root of all other sins is the sin of pride. And you think, pride? Now, that doesn't make sense. It's good to take pride in yourself, take pride in what you do. But here's why. If I am seeing myself as the highest authority, if I'm genuinely interested in being autonomous and I'm not wanting to submit to a higher law or a higher rule, then I cannot submit to God. And that's the whole point of describing Adam and Eve's fall into sin as a rebellion, because here God had clearly laid out, do not take from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, people make all sorts of arguments like, oh, was that fruit poisonous? Was there something in particular about that fruit? Like, was it an apple? And apples were just not good at the time. You know, the whole point of that, the whole point of having a tree of the knowledge of good and evil was to be a reminder, a safeguard, to remind them that they were not God, and that they were, however much freedom God gave them, and God gave them incredible freedom to eat from any tree of the garden, they needed that reminder that they were ultimately under his kingly rule by divine rights. And so when they took of the fruit, you know, it says in the Bible that Eve was deceived by the serpent, and Adam essentially ate the fruit with his eyes wide open. There's that sense that there is just sheer rebellion against God, thinking we know better than God. And the result being alienation. That's why when God comes looking for Adam, you remember what happens. He goes running. He hides in the trees, and he calls out to him, "What have you done? Have you eaten from the fruit of the tree that I told you not to eat from?" And you remember, just like us, Adam blame shifts. You know, he says, "The woman you gave me, she's the one who gave me the fruit." And of course, with that statement, chivalry died, and that was also the first case of marital conflict. But in that, we see ourselves, because, I mean, just ask yourself, how often do you hear yourself saying things like, "You have no right to say that," or "It's not my fault," or "How dare you accuse me," or how about, "Who do you think you are to judge me?" You know, that I think this self-righteous streak is something in all of us where we want to defend our own goodness. We want to justify ourselves in the sense of we are always, you know, Paul Tripp talks about this. We have an inner lawyer that's always rising up to our defense and saying, "No, it's not me. It's someone else or something else." And that's why I think, Jamie, this is why for so many people they can resonate with this. That's why it's so easy for us to blame society. It's so easy for us to blame the government. On the more personal level, it's so easy to blame a spouse or kids, or parents, the way they brought you up. But how often do we point the finger at ourselves and say, "It's because of what I've done, and I'm the one to blame for this"? And really, the whole purpose would be not that we would be self-loathing and, think, "Well, this is the end. I need to live in a hopeless state of despair now." The point is getting the right diagnosis.
Well, and I also think it's worth noting that God does not overrule our rebellion. I mean, you know, God is sovereign. God certainly has all the power, all the authority, and God can completely deal with a rebellious people. There's two options for that. On one hand, God can just completely demand or enforce by the power of his spoken word that we just be obedient to him, that we not have free will, that we not sin, that we not, and as a result, then we become, you know, robots in the service of God. Or the other option is God can wipe away to deal with the problem of an evil people. And, you know, this is something going back to your comment earlier, you know, why would a good God allow, you know, these things to happen? You hear that question a lot. And or another version of it is, why doesn't God step in and stop evil? And the answer, of course, to that one is, well, if God did step in and stop evil, then none of us would be here. None of us would exist because we're evil in relationship to the purity of God and his character and his nature. And you see in Romans 1, I think is a great picture of this, where we see what happens, how God allows us to go astray. You know, it kind of begins in verse 18 of Romans 1. It says, "For God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all godlessness and unrighteousness of people who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, since what can be known about God is evident among them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, that is, his eternal power and divine nature, has been clearly seen in the creation of the world before being understood, though through what he has made. As a result, people are without excuse, for though they knew God, they did not glorify him as God or show gratitude. Instead, their thinking became nonsense and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, four-feathered animals, and reptiles. Therefore, God delivered them over to the cravings of their heart, to to sexual impurity, so that their bodies were degraded among themselves. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served something created instead of the Creator, who is praised forever. Amen. And he goes on in that passage to say they even celebrate those who do these things with them. And what you notice here is this is not God judging in the sense of God saying, okay, I'm going to punish you. This is actually God saying, no, it's my grace that held you back from evil. And but at some point, if you keep straining against that grace, then eventually I turn you over and allow all of this evil to come forth. It's not God doing that evil. It's God allowing us to do what our heart desires in that sense.
Right. And I think maybe a helpful illustration will explain some of this. And just for seeing it as it really is, I talked about how humanism is very optimistic. And in one sense, it is. It sees a bright future ahead, utopian values coming our way. But the question is there any foundation for that perspective? Is there any real grounding for thinking that? And when you consider that in the 20th century alone, more people were killed in wars and atrocities across the globe than in any century before that, you get a sense that raising education levels, that doesn't resolve our issue. I mean, the Nazis, Germany had great education during the 20th century. It was well educated. And yet the Nazis sprung from that country. And it's not simply about having economic equality, because, you know, you could see in other places, those attempts didn't bring about true equality, and there has to be something deeper. And so it's a bit like the cancer patient who denies that he has cancer. You know, he's never going to take the cure that the doctor is prescribing if he's forever denying that he has this disease. And it's as if, you know, God, as the great physician, is offering us this remedy, this only remedy in Jesus Christ. For our sinful condition, it's the only way we'll be free of our depravity, of our corruption. And if we don't see ourselves as corrupt and as depraved, we will never receive that remedy. We will always reject him because we won't think that we need it. We won't think we need him.
Yeah, think of Proverbs. What is it? Proverbs 14:12, I think, which says, "There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death." And that's not a, it can happen, you know, sort of thing. It's a literal promise. If we walk in our own wisdom, the result will be death. You know, physical death, or relational death, or communal death, or, you know, so on and so forth. And that's what human history has shown us.
But we don't want to leave it there, obviously, even though this episode is winding to an end. We want people to understand that while this is the hard and tragic diagnosis of the human condition according to the Bible, that we are depraved and corrupt and on our own without hope. But that truth, when we embrace that, that opens us up to the greatest hope imaginable, that the God we were created for actually came to dwell with us and to bear our curse, to bear the consequences of sin, to bear the penalty of sin and the judgment of sin that we so rightly deserved. And knowing that is what opens our hearts to the truth of the gospel, knowing why he came. And that's something we're going to be talking about in this series. And I wanted to get to the nature of our will and how sin has enslaved it, and we'll talk about what that means. A lot of people misunderstand that idea of the bondage of the will, but I think that if we added some clarity maybe on the next episode, that'd be a great thing to touch on.
You've been listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time.
We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you want to subscribe, feel free to do so on iTunes or Google Play. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit us up on social media or send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. To hear past episodes, go to our website, faithunpacked.com. And as always, we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.